to reality. Each week on this program, I explore the possibilities of where we're evolving to and the access to the true essence of what it is to be human and how we're moving into new realities. Tonight's guest is an expert in ancient religions and the sort of reunification of consciousness. His name is Peter Canova, and he's the author of Pope Annalisa. Welcome, Peter, to the program.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
Good, good, good. So what I'm interested in about what you know is this resurgence of spirituality, which is really about what the old religions were really trying to tell us in the beginning, and somehow it got corrupted and got into what was called organized religion and dogma and separated us from our own spiritual connection. So you trace it back, but let's go back. How far back do you go in your research?
Probably prior to 12,000 BC, the origin of the ancient spirituality or the wisdom tradition that you alluded to, the first probably evidence we have of it that is shamanism. And shamanism, very simply, was the belief that two worlds exist side by side. There's the material world that we all perceive, and then there was the world of spirit as the shamans perceived it. And the shamans were those who would really walk back and forth between those worlds. They would get information from the invisible world, and they would bring it back in order to usually to help people for healings or for advising people or so forth. And that was the probably the early origins of people or mystic seers who would penetrate realms for higher information. And then there were different manifestations of this spiritual wisdom tradition that appeared thousands and thousands of years throughout the ages. But that's where I've traced the origin.
Well, let me just throw out a question, because people often talk about the shamanic cultures, and I've interviewed a lot of people about that. Was it just the shaman that knew that, or was that the true knowledge of the common people? I mean, we look at those cultures as if there was a specialist they called the shaman, but what I think is, and I think what we're moving into, is that everyone had access to those other worlds. It wasn't just based on what the leader or the shaman would say, although maybe they saw more. But I think all of those early civilizations were aware of other dimensions and other realities.
Well, you know, we don't have direct information to that effect, but I suspect that what you say is true. You would almost have to go into the channeled readings of psychics like Edgar Cayce to start to cite evidence. But of course, you know, you're going back into the mist of time, so that there's no historical evidence of it. But in my book, Pope Annalisa and the First Souls Trilogy, of which it's part, one of the things that I really discuss in there is the origins of our human origins. And I really do believe that there was, we have echoes in our, even our modern religions, of a fall. And this fall concerned coming from a higher realm of spirit into the material realm. Now, you can just sort of imagine that in the very earliest days of humanity, when we were closer to our source, that we probably had much more intuitive awareness. All people, as you said, probably had much more intuitive awareness of that other world from which we'd come. I think in the course of human evolution, as spirit all of a sudden found itself entangled in material forms and subject to the dangers of the material world, our minds started getting more rational and analytical in order to survive and make it, you know, in a harsh environment when saber-toothed tigers are trying to, you know, eat our ancestors for lunch. They had to get analytical pretty quick. So I think over a period of time, as spirit began to identify with the body itself, that the ability to reach into these unseen dimensions and bring information back from these unseen dimensions diminished. And so eventually it became the province of the few rather than the province of the many.
Right, and it's sort of like, yeah, we have that now, just the province of the few. Because I'm saying this because I think we're moving into a culture where everyone will access these multidimensional realities, whatever that actually means. But as you were talking, I was thinking of how ironic it is that the fall from grace or paradise, in a sense, is captured in the Old Testament, which seems like the fall itself was the emergence of religion. So there we have religion talking to us about the fall, which is the kind of input of its own dogmatic tradition as being thrown out of the garden of consciousness. Do you know what I'm saying? It is kind of ironic.
Well, I do know what you're saying. And you see, the thing is that the story of the fall, what you're referring to is our Judeo-Christian story of the fall. And the story of the fall goes back further than that. And the Judeo-Christian tradition put a particular slant on it according, to their perception or their understanding. And if you go back, for instance, to the Gnostic texts, now, the Gnostics, and that's another word, it means to know in Greek. The Gnostics were knowers or seers. And the Gnostics predated Christianity, although there were Gnostic Jews, there were Gnostic Christians, and there were even, at a later date, Gnostic Muslims. The Gnostics had a similar but different story about the fall, but the first fall that was not actually into materiality. The first fall was a change in consciousness from the consciousness of one, from the one spirit, a consciousness of total unity, into the consciousness of separation, into the consciousness of a spirit as separate entities or beings. Now, these beings were called different things in different texts. They were called angels or eons or different names that were given to them. But the first fall was actually the thought of individuality. It was the thought of separation from the whole. And then there was a subsequent or second fall of this spirit consciousness into human form. And it was that second fall, the Garden of Eden, that our Judeo-Christian tradition emphasizes. So in some regards, you could say they left out half the story, and in leaving out half the story, we left a lot of knowledge and perception on the table.
But didn't we have to take the fall in order to realize materiality, in order to reunite with the source itself?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you just hit on probably, I talk about this ancient wisdom tradition, so you probably hit on one of the prime tenets of this universal spiritual tradition. And very simply, what it says is that God or spirit is the one and only one energy that exists. It's the underlying basis of all that is. And that light or consciousness, that consciousness of spirit expresses itself through the medium of light. And this And when you have something that is all-encompassing, a totality, it can have being and existence, but it doesn't have experience, because experience is only something that can be gained in contrast to something else. So the totality, or the one consciousness, split itself up into many points of light or many points of consciousness, ultimately ended up entangled in human forms. But it was this whole projection outward of the spirit and breaking itself up, in a sense forgetting itself and allowing itself to become ignorant of its own existence in different degrees, that created the perception of individual experience. So you're completely right. In order to even have a sense of us ourselves as individuals, this projection or this breaking up or this stepping down of limitation in consciousness had to occur.
So, the Gnostics are a strange bunch. I've read some Gnostic literature, and, definitely the gnosis is a direct knowing, but some of the literature says that this world is really in darkness. I mean, they sort of have, this is the underworld, and the return to spirit is the light, and we have it backwards. What we think is light is dark, and what we think is dark is light. Is that true about the Gnostics?
Well, you got to remember about the Gnostics. They grouped them together under one name, and they all had similar core teachings, but there were really many nuances amongst the Gnostics. Some of the Gnostics viewed the world as totally evil, and the idea was to escape it. Many other Gnostics did not view it that way, so there wasn't like a monolithic belief. But I think what you could say in general is the Gnostics believed that this was a mixed world of light and darkness, and it really gets into this matter of consciousness that we talked about, because when consciousness projected itself outward to create individual points of experience, there was a certain ignorance involved by necessity. And think of it this way. When you have a DVD, and you make a copy of that DVD, and then a copy from that one, and a copy from that one, they all express the same essence of what's on the DVD, but with less clarity. Each copy, each generation, has a little less clarity and resolution than the one before it. And the analog to the spirit projecting itself out is that each level of consciousness had a little less clarity of the source. And when you work it all the way down onto the material level, that's the least light or the least clarity of all, the least awareness of the source. So what we call evil shades into extreme ignorance of our source, total belief that materiality is the be-all and end-all that allows people to engage in acts and ways of thinking that, you know, are unwholesome. But in actuality, the world is a mixture of different levels of consciousness, different levels of light and darkness, different levels of ignorance and awareness.
Mm. So, but if we take the beginning of Western thought, I mean, so the Gnostics, do they predate Judaism, or is Judaism a branch of Gnosticism? Or
Gnostics predated both Judaism and Christianity, but here's the interesting thing about it. There were Jewish Gnostics, and in fact, the Kabbalah that still survives today is a direct offshoot of Jewish Gnosticism. The Sufis, which still survive in Islam, are a direct offshoot of Islamic Gnosticism. Gnostics themselves, or Gnostic Christians, pretty much disappeared from the scene because the Catholic Church did such a magnificent job of physically destroying them and their works. But Jesus of Nazareth, for instance, came along, many Jews and early Christians recognized his teachings as Gnostically inspired teachings, and they embraced his ministry as being the highest expression or the most recent expression of a revealer of the light of this Gnostic wisdom, of this ancient wisdom. And so many of them became amongst the earliest Christians. So it did predate Judaism and Christianity, but it was a tradition that became inextricably bound into Jewish mysticism and into Christian mysticism. In fact, it was the mystic foundation of all three Abrahamic religions. The Sufis in Islam, the Gnostics in Christianity, and the Kabbalah in Judaism were all the mystic expressions of the ancient spiritual tradition in those respective religions.
But it must also go back to Egypt as well, and the traditions of thought that became Hermes, right? I mean, there must be some Egyptian influence.
Yeah, absolutely. The Hermet, you know, again, I say this is a universal tradition. You can look in Sumeria, India, the British Isles, amongst the Druids. The Hermetic wisdom out of ancient Egypt was another expression that predated, it probably predated Judaism, but certainly at a very early stage of human history, this Hermetic thought was another branch of the universal wisdom tradition that was preserved in ancient mystery schools, which were almost like an Ivy League chain of academies that stretched all the way around the world, and the people would have to go through initiation into learning these mysteries to keep the flame of this ancient wisdom alive.
So it's been kept alive. I mean, alchemists were part of that ancient wisdom tradition as well, right? The whole alchemical
Yeah. In fact, what happened was when the church suppressed the Gnostics and destroyed Gnostic Christianity, you can sort of suppress these spiritual things, but you can never eliminate them because they're essentially written upon the human soul. So they will always crop up like pressing a ping pong ball on one side, it'll pop out the other. And in the medieval times, after they'd done a good job on the Gnostics, say by around 400 A.D. or so, 500 A.D., they'd really started to weed out the Gnostics. In medieval times, you started getting outcroppings of this. The tarot cards, for instance, are completely based on Gnostic symbology. The alchemists, the Knights Templars, Freemasonry, Rosicrucians, these different movements were all, expressions of Gnostic wisdom tradition, and the Cathars also. The Cathar religion in southern France that was destroyed by the church was probably the last great Gnostic church. But you have a number of things like alchemy in medieval times that appear with all these Gnostic attributes.
Yeah, I want to get into the Cathars because I was just in the south of France. But before I do that, I want to know the connection then to the divine feminine, what you write about in the Pope Annalisa story. How does that feminine essence tie into that ancient knowing?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of, I guess you could say, a lot of smoke swirling around the whole issue of the divine feminine or the sacred feminine, and it's gotten politicized because, you know, the feminism really has nothing to do with the divine feminine except very, very, very remotely. But just to make it really simple, the divine or sacred feminine was a recognition that God, the one unity, expressed itself into two primary poles that they called male and female in ancient times. And it was the interaction between these two polar forces that created the friction and the motion and the energy to propel creation. So that's even reflected in our body chemistry, our body structures. Probably many listeners are familiar with the right and the left brain hemisphere theory. So they say that the left brain, for instance, is called the male side. That has to do with function and analysis. It uses analytic thought to break things into component parts. It uses logic and verbalized language to perceive and express itself. So it's the basic thought mode for science and math. And then on the other side of the ledger, you have the right brain or the female side, and that has to do with design and creativity. So it uses holistic thought, which looks for the unity in the parts rather than the parts in the unity, and it uses intuition and creativity to perceive and express itself, and that's the basic thought mode behind art and philosophy. So the ancient wisdom said that in order for us to really understand the functioning of the higher aspects of our life, we have to get in touch with both sides of ourselves, because we have these male and female faculties within each of us. It's not like the females only have the female side and the males have the male side. Each of us has these faculties within them, the intuition and feeling on one side, the logic and analysis on the other side. And the ancients said that what we have to do is integrate those, and that when we bring our hearts and our minds together and we contemplate these mystic traditions, then we really open the gates to higher perception.
Right, and that's what the Gnostics were, really in touch with a higher perception of reality. But I thought there was a kind of a focus particularly on the feminine, you know, with the Mary Magdalene traditions, with the goddess traditions, where in a way what I read is that the feminine is what this world is. It's a manifestation of the feminine as material, as matter, mata. And what is the male essence is the energy that gives life or the power to the matter. So the world itself is an extension of the feminine.
Well, that's right. That's right on target. Let me put it this way. Going back to the Gnostics. The Gnostics had the myth of the fall of Sophia, which was a feminine aspect of God, and it was the feminine aspect of God that led the way into the separation or the idea of separate identity, and ultimately to the creation of the physical world. And essentially the force, or that female force, morphed into the very world itself, morphed into the very world of nature. And you're correct about the role of the male in that. The female side of it was the creative force that gave birth to everything we know. The male side of it was that energy that gave structure and order to this, so it would happen in an orderly way. In all the ancient traditions, it was always said that it was the female aspect of God that was the one that led opened the gate, let's say, and birthed the world of individuality and materiality. And, you know, it's interesting because in the Gnostic Sophia, which was the feminine aspect of God. Sophia means wisdom. And you say to yourself, well, wisdom led the fall from spirit consciousness down here. What's so wise about that? But when you think about it, how does wisdom become wise? Wisdom, you only gain wisdom through experience, through direct experience. And the Hindus had a great saying about the material world, which is, it's the playground in which God fools himself. So it was this whole thrust into an experience of, instead of being one, of being many, that was the feminine force that was leading that thrust out to create everything we know in the phenomenal world.
Right. So, but you talk about how it was the Christians that sort of started to mess up the perennial wisdom, but I think it started, you know, with the formalization of Judaic thought, you know, and then maybe before that. So, I mean, the Christian church, even though Jesus came to change what the old temple was doing, perpetuated that, and there was more and more separation until we are totally separate now. Isn't that the sort of lineage of the separation?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that the Catholic Church, when you think of it in a lot of ways, was an imitation of Judaism at the time of Christ. I mean, you had a pope at one time in Judaism that was called the high priest, and you had the cardinals that were called the Sanhedrin. And essentially the Catholic Church ended up modeling itself on that, and that was a structure, of course, that, you know, Jesus was protesting against because it was promoting the law as opposed to understanding. So, yes, in that regard, it certainly did begin with Judaism, but on the other hand, you still have the Kabbalah today. So parallel with the formulation of the Jewish law, you still kept the mystic tradition within Judaism that still exists today in the Kabbalah, whereas in Christianity, Gnosticism was thoroughly destroyed. The only way we even know that such a thing as a Gnostic existed is by these fortuitous finds in the deserts of the Middle East, like the famous big find in 1945 in Nag Hammadi, Egypt, where the bulk of the modern Gnostic Gospels were recovered. Now, if we had not recovered those, we would hardly know anything about the Gnostics and what they were saying, whereas the body of Judaistic Kabbalism has existed in different forms from ancient times up through the Middle Ages with the Lurianic Kabbalah and so forth. So that's why I say yes and no. The Christian Church, the Catholic Church, just did a great job in destroying its own mystical foundation.
Yeah, but Jesus himself seems like a Gnostic. What he's teaching is very Gnostic in its original intent, in its pure intent.
No question about it. In fact, one of the things that I talk about when I do my talks around the country is the two Christianities. There were really two streams of Christianity, and there was a mystical tradition that Jesus was teaching to certain people, and then there were the mass teachings, which were like the parables and so forth. And we know this because it says it right in the Bible. I mean, there's numerous passages in the Bible where Jesus says to the disciples, unto you are given the keys to the kingdom of heaven, unto those without, you know, are given parables. And also in the writings of the early church fathers, like Clement of Alexandria, Clement mentions that there was a secret gospel and a secret teaching that was being taught to the spiritually mature. But they would never verbally divulge the secret teachings of the Lord to those who were not ready for it. So we have several different sources that indicate that there were two streams in ancient Christianity. Unfortunately, the outer church, or, you know, the church of let's say, the church of limited understanding, the outer church, at one point decided it could no longer tolerate its own mystics that were saying something a little bit different, and it ended up destroying them.
Well, you said, and that happens. It's happening all. It's still happening now. You know, anytime someone stands up and says, "No, I think we should do it differently," or it's happening in science. But going back to you saying the Gnostics were destroyed, but there was this current that emerged in the south of France with the Cathars. Now, who were the Cathars, and what did they? What was their connection to these Gnostics?
Well, the classic Gnostic church was destroyed. Classic Gnosticism was pretty much destroyed by around 500 AD. But in medieval France, a movement came about, and they called them the Cathars, which is a Greek word for the purity, to make something cathartic is to purify it. And the Cathars were primarily a female-led church, and they were huge. They basically were the primary religion in the Languedoc area of southern France, which was the most prosperous area of France in medieval times. They were healers. They were vegetarians. They practiced. They believed that the world was, as you said a little bit earlier, and as many of the early Gnostics believed, that this was a world that we need to escape, that this was a world that was engulfed in darkness, and that it was the goal of the Cathars to purify their consciousness to the point where they were able to rise above this and return to the source of light. Now, different traditions talk about how the Cathars got started. Scholarly tradition, Orthodox scholarly tradition generally holds that the Gnostics came from a group called the Bogomils, who were in the Balkan Peninsula in the area of Serbia or northern Greece, and that prior to that they stemmed from Armenia. But the Gnostic teachings of these groups spread eventually to southern France. Now, there are other traditions that tie the presence of the Gnostic thought in southern France to Mary Magdalene, who legend has escaped after the crucifixion and, at least for a period of time, lived in that same area where the Gnostics were centered.
Mm. But they were a real threat to the church. I mean, they didn't have anything they wrote down. No one has found any Cathar texts, which is very strange, isn't it? That there's nothing left behind. And
well, there are a few. There are a few Cathar texts. It's not that strange because when the King of France decided that he wanted to gain control of the South, which had all the wealth, and the Pope in Rome at the time decided that you could not tolerate a church that stood in opposition to Rome, they formed the only crusade that has ever been launched by Christians against other Christians. It was called the Albigensian Crusade. And over a period of 100 years, the French and papal forces systematically went around destroying and literally burning the Cathars out of existence. I mean, they put a lot of people to the stake. Every Cathar writing they could find, they put to the flame. So they did just as thorough a job on the Cathars as the earlier Orthodox Church had done on the Gnostics themselves. And the other aspect of that is that the most sacred teachings of all these Gnostic groups were really never committed to writing. They were oral teachings. So they were transmitted mouth to mouth, ear to ear, and face to face, as the ancient Jewish Gnostics used to say, because they did not want to risk having writings that could be taken over by people who would misuse them, abuse them, and twist them. So it was primarily an oral tradition. Of course, the downside of an oral tradition is that when the practitioners of it are exterminated, you get a break in the chain of the wisdom. So it's not that surprising that Cathar texts survived that Holocaust.
You know, some people think they actually brought it into Spain, and where the Catalans, even till today, hold some of the mystical Catalans. I was just there in the town of Girona, hold some of the secrets from that time, and actually even some of the treasures, possibly, of the Second Temple that was brought to France. I don't know if you know about that, but the Catalans, or the mystical ones, are a very strange group of people. Do you know about that?
Well, yeah, there's several legends around. There's also legends that, you know, some of the treasures of the Second Temple, which were brought back to France by the Knights Templars, when the King of France decided to get rid of them, that supposedly a group of them had, some of their treasures brought over to Switzerland, actually, in modern-day Switzerland. So there's several, different legends of these things, some of which may not be true at all, some of which may have truth to them. It's kind of hard to say. We haven't really found any verification yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if such things exist somewhere.
Well, there was a Cathar treasure that somehow disappeared You know, they were after some of these cathart artifacts. The church is what I heard. You've heard about that, the treasures of
Yeah, and I've heard the exact same thing about the Templar treasure too. That when they basically thought they were going to get a treasure trove, after killing the last Grand Master, they came up empty-handed. That the Templars had secreted these things out of the country, and that was the legend that said that it went over to Switzerland.
Anyway, I mean, we can talk about the history a lot, but I think what the real aspect of your work is the spiritual essence, like what, you know, and how this universal mystical tradition is really who we are, essentially, and how part of what you want to do is bring that awareness back to people of this divine connection, right? I mean, the origins of the destiny of humanity. And how we return to the source.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you think about it, look at the difference in paradigms here from our traditional religions today, as opposed to what the ancient mystical tradition was saying. Now, let's take a page from the Judeo-Christian tradition, which is essentially what we are here in the West. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, there is a separation of humanity from God's essence and the source of our own consciousness by having us believe that we were created out of nothing, basically. We were lumps of dust, and God breathed life into us, and, you know, we sinned, and we're forever trying to, you know, regain God's good grace by being, you know, good people, and we're a separated life form from God. Now, we do have a soul, but it's a soul that's going to be judged by this sort of stern, paternal God. And we can only hope for salvation external to ourselves, not from within ourselves. Now, this is a big difference from what the ancient spiritual tradition was saying, because the ancient spiritual tradition said there is no separation between God and humanity, that the humanity is God in a certain state of expression, and that we all contain this spark of divine consciousness in us, and that through practice we can come to a remembrance of our source, and that we can have direct contact with our own divine source, and this is a contact that can guide us in this life and really be a transformative experience in terms of our consciousness while still here on Earth, not having to have to wait for resurrection after death, but we can essentially resurrect our own spiritual consciousness here while we're on Earth. And that's a massively different paradigm from how we've been separated from our spiritual source by Judeo-Christianity. And the thing that we have to remember is this, that this view, that the spiritual view of human beings being expressions, direct expressions of God and containing the essence of God within them and containing this knowledge within them, this was the prevailing view of the entire world prior to the advent of Christianity. Christianity represented a break in this chain, and it was the oddball coming in and saying, no, wait a minute, you know, this is something else. They took the Jewish tradition, essentially, and they made it the prevailing view of the entire Western world. But the native European traditions, like the Druids, for instance, were in complete harmony with the other ends of the earth in terms of their understanding of this universal spiritual tradition. So our chain in the West here was broken, and we were severed spiritually from the West of the rest of the world. But these precepts that we're talking about of the ancient spiritual tradition, you still find them today in Buddhism and Hinduism. They survive, you know, quite well in those religions today. We were once much closer to them in our beliefs before Orthodox Christianity became the prevailing brand of Christianity, and there were many brands of Christianity back then, but Orthodox Christianity became the prevailing brand, and then from that point on, the story was rewritten.
But don't you think it was the Jewish tradition that was the original break from it? But just Christianity made it more worldwide. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It originated with the Jewish tradition, but Christianity essentially spread it around the globe.
But I also do think, and I don't want to get back into history too much, that the Egyptian high priest had already co-opted the spirituality from its people anyway, and that was the break with Akhenaten, you know, wanting to return to the to the solar gods, you know?
Well, so, yeah, you know, look, you have many instances of this. Yeah. I mean, you know, even in the ancient legends of Atlantis, you have this whole thing happening between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. It's a repetitive theme that happens, you know, throughout history, but the fact is that in the historical epoch that we know and that we have records of, it certainly occurred with the Jews and the Christians.
Right. So anyway, so this is our tradition now. So how do we return to that space? I mean, I guess the Native Americans never forgot it. I mean, there's lots of traditions still with us. You know, there's parts of the Hindu path that is the road to that awakening of that God-centered self. It's just in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we need a middleman, which is what the Gnostics were saying we didn't need. So what are the practical aspects of returning to the source, as you see it?
Well, I think that is really a matter of one individual at a time, of each consciousness awakening. And collectively, you see kind of an uplifting movement. And I think we already see evidence of that. I mean, you cited at the beginning of the show something that I think a lot of people feel, and actually I think something that they're statistically showing in polls that they take. Newsweek came out with a front cover, kind of, you know, you can almost kind of expect the secular people at Newsweek were probably jumping up and down for joy with this, but it said religion is dead in America. Well, if you really look more into the numbers, religion may be dying, but spirituality is rebirthing. So to the extent that dogmatic religions are losing people, spiritual pursuits are gaining. And I think that this is a natural evolution, that we've been through several stages of human consciousness now. We started off with the feminine, we swung over to the masculine. Now I see, you know, we're reaching our highest expression, which is using both in unison to gain higher perceptions, and that movement is really kind of sweeping around the globe. You see a huge uptick in interest in spiritual matters, spiritual books, even in some ways you could say interest in the paranormal. That's a little bit of a pejorative or bastardized expression of it, but all these things indicate that people are abandoning the dogmas and the old stories, and they're looking deeper and in a more penetrating way into the mysteries of life, and they're becoming spiritual warriors. You know, if you really want to progress in life, you have to be a little bit of a warrior. You have to get out there. You have to buck against the tide. You have to read. You have to become a little bit of a philosopher. So you find more and more people are taking the time away from, you know, the grunt work of life, and they're looking at these pursuits. And as they learn and as their consciousness changes, it's like the 100 monkeys. At some point, you reach a critical mass, and, you know, I think things start to really transform.
And you even say quantum physics is part of this transformation of consciousness. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, you know, the fact of the matter is it's really astonishing how quantum physics is essentially saying the same thing about the origins of matter, the origins of the world, and really the whole essence of what it is to be a human being. And, you know, if you think the Gnostics are complicated, quantum physics can get extremely complicated, so I'm going to do my best to try and really simplify this. Just into a couple points, because there's many things that we could talk about. But there's two branches of quantum physics. One is relativistic physics, and that's the physics of very large objects like planetary galactic scale. This was the physics of Albert Einstein. On the other side, you have quantum physics, which is the physics of very small. That's the physics of subatomic particles, atoms, molecules, and the subatomic particles that lie beneath them. Well, in the turn of the century, both branches of physics started to make a startling discovery, and they worked their way towards the middle. Einstein came out with his famous equation, E equals MC squared. And what essentially that says is that matter and energy, or light, are interchangeable forms of the same substance. That matter originates in light or energy, and it resolves or dissolves back into light. On the other side of the ledger, when the quantum physicists really started boring down at the most minute levels of subatomic particles, they found out that there was no such thing as particles at all. At the very basis of reality, there was only light, light waves, waves of light. And these waves of light contained all possibilities, all outcomes, and all possibilities. Now, it was only at a certain juncture that this light would convert to point particles, which forms the matter that we know. And the collapse of this light wave into point particles has to do with a conscious observer. In laboratory experiments, they would find that these waves of light, when unobserved, the phenomena would exist as waves of light. But as soon as you try to see them or measure them, the light collapses into point particles. So it's the act of observing or measuring, which is the act of a conscious observer, that transforms the light into matter itself. So what both branches of quantum physics are essentially saying is there's really no such thing as matter at a fundamental level. It's all light energy. And through a certain process or event, this energy collapses into particles, which then in turn form the material objects that we see. Now, this is the same thing that the ancients were saying. They said that God is light, and light energy is the foundation of all that exists. It sounded pretty vague and nebulous at one point. It's the kind of stuff that you'd hear bandied around, you know, New Age spiritual circles. But now with quantum physics, it has an objective scientific basis to it.
Right. It seems like human consciousness affects reality. I think that's ultimately what that experiment with light shows, is because we're observing something, we affect it, and we affect it in ways that we can actually be more responsible for. As we grow spiritually, we can have more direct impact on reality that's created around us. So I totally agree with that mystical kind of input from quantum physics, because that's what it seems like everything is telling us in all the studies I've done. The big thing is I'm interested in, because you also talk about 2012. Now, what does that mean to you from a scientific and mystical point of view?
Well, you know, 2012, there's a lot of, like sacred feminism, there's a lot of stuff going around about 2012, and, you know, I try and simplify everything, and my simple take on 2012 is just this, that we've now have an understanding that light is the source of everything, and light is intelligence. Light carries information in it. This has been proven. Light has weight, it has mass, it has photons that carry information. It's this information contained in light that essentially ultimately forms the shape of our physical world. In 2012, it's the first time in hundreds of thousands of years that our solar system comes into direct alignment with the center of our galaxy. Now, the center of our galaxy has been shown to be the greatest source of light energy in our part of the universe, the greatest source of electromagnetic energy in our part of the universe. So that when our solar center is directly exposed to the light of the galaxy, we are going to be bombarded essentially by electromagnetic radiation. Now, in some regards, this will have direct effects on the Earth, a few Earth changes. But in a spiritual sense, to me, what it seems to do is essentially afford an opportunity for those who have sensitized their own tuning forks to heighten their own consciousness. I think this is why, you know, they say, well, you know, around 2012, this is a period when consciousness will heighten. Well, again, that's a statement that sounds a little vague and mystical. But if you take it from the standpoint of being exposed at the highest levels of this light energy coming from the center of our galaxy, then it seems to take on a little bit more of a scientific basis here. That you know, but like anything else, the more people are sensitized to these understandings, the more information they will, you know, derive from this. But I think it does represent an opportunity for the reasons stated of seeing a sort of a general uplift in the level of conscious awareness from 2012 on.
Well, I think it's already happening. I mean, a lot of the people like I talked to on this program are already, and that's what I was saying in the beginning of the program, they're already in touch with a sort of multidimensional awareness. So what I think is that this light that is coming from the center of the galaxy will ignite more of our capacity to know, more of our brain, more of, will come online and will be in touch with what the Gnostics really knew, which, you know, I think it's so mysterious because they were, it pure knowing is the direct connection to source. But when you are connected to source like that, so many more things become obvious. I mean, I think the story of Jesus, or Jesus himself, is someone who had Gnostic wisdom that reunited with the Father, or whatever you want to call it, and that's possible for all of us to live in that state of awareness. I think this is where we're moving to as a mass culture, as a society. I mean, that seems like the only way, doesn't it?
Well, remember this, that each of us is an expression of light energy. We are crystallized light, and so our source is the same light energy from which the ascended or the masters came from, the Jesus, the people like Jesus, Buddha, Krishna. You know, we are of the same light source. So these potentialities are within all of us to the degree that we reawaken ourselves or remember our source, and it happens. It's not uniform. It's staggered throughout history and throughout the, you know, different consciousness of different people. But we all have that potentiality within us. And if we're being bombarded with greater amounts of light, our brains essentially are light tuning forks. We crystallize from light into material form, and a lot of that has to do with the brain being kind of like the receiver. We don't see television signals or radio signals like coming out of your station, but when it hits a receiver like a TV set, all of a sudden we see images on there, and we say, hey, where did that come from? We can't see it, but we know the images are there. Well, the brain is the same way. There's an archetypical world out there. There's a world of blueprints where all these things that we perceive as three-dimensional objects are already exist in the form of blueprints out there that Jung has called archetypes. And they're light frequency images. That's what archetypes are. They're light frequency images that exist in another dimension. They're transmitted to our brains, which are picked up like TV sets or receivers, and we basically spit that back out through the prism of our consciousness to form the material world that we know.
Well, but tell me about, you know, obviously something got you into all this, something awakened in you. Can you tell me your personal story and how you accessed this within yourself, or what happened to you? Because it's usually
when
something...
I was in my 20s, I discovered, after going through a course where we were kind of looking to increase our higher perception, what they called ESP in those days, I discovered I was a medical intuitive. And lo and behold, all they had to do was give me the name, age, and address of any person anywhere in the world, and I was getting all this accurate information about their physical condition, or even their emotional or psychic condition. We had index cards, and we would sit in pairs opposite one another, one person holding the information in the card, the other person doing the reading, and all they could give you was the name, age, and address of a person, and then all they could say was yes or no, or I don't have that information, to verify the information that you were giving them against what was on the card. And when I found I could do these readings so clearly, it really led me to an awakening that we must all be connected in a matrix of energy together. We must all be part of the same energy field, that I would be able to get such information about other people in this manner. So being the kind of Capricorn I am, it wasn't good enough for me just to have the intuitive experience. I decided that I really needed to understand the nuts and bolts. And I wanted to understand how, you know, the operation behind this. And I began a lifelong study of research using both science and ancient spirituality to understand what I had already been experiencing myself. But after I had the awakening of being a medical intuitive, it was like the floodgate opened up. I had clairvoyant, clairaudient, remote viewing experiences, premonitions, things that would, you know, come to pass, all things that would be objectified in the outside world, so that, you know, proving to me that this was not just, you know, fantasy. And I was getting so much information, so much accurate information, that I was really, you know, in contact with what I would call, you know, a higher intelligence, or an intelligence that at least went beyond the perceptions that, you know, I would normally experience. And this was a Gnostic experience for me. This was like a direct experience, a direct contact with higher information. And the transformation that occurred to me was that, you know, I knew all the things that I was taught in church about spirit, about God, about everything else. But to tell you the truth, it was always just a hope. It was always just words. It was something that I had to take on faith. Faith is a proposition that you have to take on the word of others. But when you have these direct experiences of this force in operation, you now own it. It's part of your direct experience. You know it to be true. So you graduate from faith to knowledge.
So is that still happening for you? Are you still connected with that same power?
Oh, yeah, it does, but in a different way. I mean, first of all, I gave up doing the intuitive medical readings many years ago for a variety of reasons. But, you know, for instance, I'll give you an example of how it works. I can give you several examples, but I'll give you an example through the book I wrote, Pope Annalisa. When I started that book about over a decade ago, the first plot line I had was the backdrop was going to be America going into a war with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And then, lo and behold, the first Gulf War happened. And I said, oh, okay, that's a little dated. Let's change this to a second Gulf War with Saddam Hussein's sons involved. Well, that happened, and, you know, we know about Uday and Qusay, the sons. And I said, okay, now we're going to switch the plot line to Iran going nuclear and getting into a confrontation with the West. Well, we read in the news every day where that's gone. So, you see, I mean, even these global events, I was getting these years before they occurred, and I was writing them into the draft of the book itself. And, you know, that's just one example, but this information comes through in many different ways. But what I found is at one time I get a lot of this information in meditation. I don't even have to meditate now. It just kind of bleeds through my everyday consciousness.
Well, what are you, I mean, so you're a real Gnostic in a way, but what are you getting now? What's coming? Do you get any impressions about the world?
About, impressions about what?
The world, I mean, you know, what are you tuning into now? What are you getting at? I mean, what are you picking up?
Well, you know, to tell you honestly, I've been spending so much time marketing my book, Pope Annalisa, that I kind of don't, you know, I get the information where my mind is tending to go. So at the time when I was writing the book and I was, you know, looking for a backdrop of the, you know, world geopolitical situation, I was getting all this information through. My mind really hasn't been dwelling on those things lately. It's more like, you know, I've got this message that I'm sort of trying to spread concerning the things you and I are talking about on the phone now, and I'm trying to, you know, I'm working on the book, and actually a lot of expression of interest in making the book into a movie now. So that's what I'm mostly spending my time on. But I will say this in general, I do have an optimistic view of the world. I mean, we're going to go through rough patches, no doubt, but I do see at the end of the day that there's going to come a time, like is depicted in the book, where the consciousness of people is going to get to the point where they just kind of won't put up with it anymore. I mean, I think you're starting to see now really the seeds of that happening. The old order in America and really in the world is breaking down. Our financial institutions, you know, our political institutions, these type of things are breaking down. And when they break down, a new paradigm has to occur. And I see that as the vacuum into which a new consciousness is going to move. Now, I'm not going to sit here and predict the exact way it's going to happen, the mediums, the people involved, or whatever. But I do believe that we're going to go through a rough period of time. And at the end of it, we're going to emerge very, very differently over the course of the next, I'm going to say, decade to two decades.
Right. So I know your book, Pope Annalisa, really deals with a lot of these topics that we've been covering. I mean, just how would you sum it up in general, the book, as a kind of mouthpiece for your philosophy?
Well, let me just say a couple things about the book. First of all, for those people who are listening, you can go to my website, popeannalisa.com. That's popeannalisa.com. It contains a wealth of information about things we're talking about tonight and more, videos and a lot of other good stuff on there. The book Pope Annalisa is part of a trilogy called The First Souls, which concerns the first souls to fall into material experience from the higher realms, from higher consciousness. And Pope Annalisa, itself is about an African nun who essentially, through a series of circumstances, rises to become Pope of the Catholic Church and proceeds to turn everything upside down on its head. But the world also is closing in around her. America is about to go to war with Iran, a nuclear exchange, and a lot of people are saying, wow, things have gotten worse than she's been on the world scene here. And so is she really going to be the solution, or is she the cause of the problems? So it's going to take four people racing against time to really learn, you know, what her secret is. But we're seeing a restoration in the book of a lot of the knowledge that we're talking about here, and it's envisioned in very practical ways, because you say, oh, come on, how could a woman ever become pope? No one's done that in 2,000 years. Well, it doesn't make sense when I tell it to you like that, but when you read it in the context of the book, you'll see how the story unfolds. It almost makes eminent sense, and how the spirituality that we're talking about that's coming to address the shortcomings of both materialistic science and orthodox dogmatic religions, how that is unfolding, you know, through the action in the book. So it's really captivated many people, and I'm fortunate in that it's won 7 National Book Awards in less than a year of publication.
Wow. Who published it?
Well, you know, I had to end up publishing it myself, Alan, because HarperCollins almost picked it up, but when they didn't, we got into a bad economy, and I soon came to the decision that no publishing company was going to pick up a big epic work by a first-time author. And I went and I self-published it myself, and what I've been doing is I've been promoting it around the country, and what with the winning of the awards, it's kind of becoming kind of a like a almost like a little bit of a cult item here. And you know, the book sales are going very well. You can buy the book through my website or on Amazon. And it's I've now gotten expressions of interest from some powerful people in Hollywood who and incidentally there's a real spiritual wave going on in that town too. And they've interested in making a movie out of it in order to kind of, you know, get this whole story out.
No, I know, and this is the first of three. I know it's a thick book. It's the first of three books coming out.
Yes, it's the first of three. Right.
Are the other ones written already? Or are you in the process of writing them?
One of them is written substantially in draft form, but there's going to be huge revisions in it. And as soon as I have time to take off from marketing this first book, I'll complete the writing of it. But you know, a lot of the what I also do is I travel around the country and I do a lot of speaking at different venues, large and small, and I talk about many of the things that we've spoken about tonight. So with the research that I do for those presentations, I also use that research to incorporate into my book. So even though I'm not actively writing as much as I want to right now in terms of the book itself, the background of research materials falling into place so that at the time I, you know, do have a spare moment to sit down and really put my pen back to it, it should be a much better work.
Well, it was a big book to dive into, but I'm going to dive into that, and I appreciate you sending it to me. And it's exciting work, because I think that through literature is what plants seeds in people's minds to help them change into what we know to be true.
Yeah, you know, I really thought this could have easily been another self-help book or nonfiction book, but I looked around the marketplace and I said, wow, there's a ton of people, you know, especially like these Hay House authors that are doing this stuff, and you know, they can probably do it better than I could. Why do I want to drop my hat into that arena? But I really felt, again, going back to this male and female heart and mind principle, that the way that people could best absorb this material and best learn it is by living it through the lives of the characters in a very interesting page-turning novel. And this is, incidentally, a page-turner. It is not a Catholic book. It's a book that, uses the Catholic Church as the vehicle to tell a universal tale about the origin and the destiny and the purpose of humanity. And it's a page turner. Some people just read it just strictly for the, you know, the thrill of it. Other people get a lot of spiritual content out of it.
Yeah, some of the Steve, the guy who's I guess he's your publicist, said this is the real, you know, you're the real guy behind, in a sense, the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, he likes to call me the real-life Robert Langdon from the Da Vinci Code. Of course, that's my PR guy. He's being a good PR guy. But I think what he means by that is that, you know, I'm putting a different slant on the ancient text than anybody really has ever done before, especially the way I'm tying it into quantum physics and all these other things. And it's sort of like I'm reassembling the pieces of stuff that's not very understandable in its original form to people and bringing it to them, bringing it home to them in the form of, you know, a story that just really captivates them. And so it's sort of like really, you know, well, I guess you could say what I'm really doing is I'm taking, you know, the stories of these seers from the past and bringing them back to life in a way that modern people can understand.
Well, thank you. Thanks for being a guest. Do you want to, you have any closing words that you would like to tell people about their own Gnostic wisdom? Because I think that is really what you're trying to do, is have people tap into their own divine connection.
Yeah, not directly about the Gnostics, but indirectly, yes. I think my what my message is this. The things that I experience are not unique. I'm not unique. Everybody can contact this higher wisdom, this higher information, if you have the dedication and you work at it and you read about it and you think about it. And again, you know, I did it both ways. I did good old-fashioned book learning, book reading, and I also meditated and had things channeled through my own meditation. And a lot of this information that is in the book that subsequently came to pass was a result of those two streams. But that's how we work. We work through heart and mind, and I really hope that when people read this book, that it gives them a perspective on how they can further their own spiritual path so that they can, you know, get to the point where they, too, have these experiences that can be transformative in their own lives.
Well, I think a lot of the people listening to this program probably are already tapped into something like that, because I sort of do the program for people who are beyond the beginner stage, but I think, you know, we need these bridges for people who don't realize that potential. So I mean, thank you for doing that.
Yeah, and hopefully for those people, what it might do for them is, if many of the concepts and many of the things in the book is familiar, hopefully it just connects the dots in a different way that gives them a framework to help them validate their own spiritual journey.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think we need to keep validating this, because it is, in a way, an individual path. You know, we need to keep supporting each other in this evolution that seems to be unfolding right in front of us. So, thank you. Thank you for contributing to that. I look forward to diving into that.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on your show tonight.
And maybe we'll do a Gnostic roundtable at some point. I know a bunch of other people are talking about Gnostic traditions from different perspectives. So are you interested in that?
Sure, I'd be happy to participate.
All right, great. You're where are you located mostly, Virginia?
Well, I'm kind of all over the place, various times, Florida, California, Massachusetts. It kind of depends, but we'll stay in touch.
All right, if you're in New York, let me know. We'll also do like a television show as well.
Okay, sounds great.
Thanks. I've been talking to Peter Canova. And your website again is PopeAnnalisa.com?
PopeAnnalisa, one word, .com.
Thanks. Thank you. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening tonight. This is
I walk in fire, feel the flame, feel the pain, get up again, go on. like a star, like a star, like a star. Like a star.